All right. I hope you enjoyed learning these sources. I enjoyed listening to you learning the sources. They're incredibly relevant. This is the questions that come up in medical halacha, end of life issues. This is really ends up being the primary issues that arise. In fact, as new technologies arise, and you often think, how could the rabbis have imagined these new technologies? It ends up being these sources that we go back to. And in fact, I'm going to go through some of the sources with you, but I'm going to make sure to mention a number of new technologies. It's not just respirators, although that's one very common and prominent example, but there's a lot of new medical technologies that we end up looking to these sources to decipher. I'll start with an anecdote just so you to understand. A couple of years ago, I was asked to present at a conference on end-of-life issues in general, and I was asked to share about Jewish approaches. So I shared the issue of withholding versus withdrawing, and I said that we distinguish between withholding and withdrawing. And one person in the audience, also a Jewish, it wasn't a Jewish conference, but a Jewish person in the audience, raised his hand and got extremely upset at me, and he said, "That's not Jewish, that's Catholic. That's the Catholic approach. They distinguish between withholding and withdrawing. That's not a Jewish approach. We do not distinguish between withholding and withdrawing, and I take offense and umbrage to your characterization that that's Jewish approach." So that's all he said, and I was a little taken aback, and it forced me to kind of relook at the sources and think, is he right? Did the rabbis just say, like, well, let's see, what's the Catholic approach, and let's just follow that?
This is Aaron. Just a quick clarification. Was this, to your knowledge, another Froome person?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he even mentioned, he sort of said, like, and don't try to claim that that's the Orthodox approach because I'm Orthodox. So, because in the bioethics world, it is a big debate. And what?
And you're not.
Right, yes. And because in the bioethics world, it is a big debate. And maybe it's become majority today that don't accept the distinction between holding and withdrawing, and we'll come to that. I'll talk about it because it came up a lot actually during COVID and other contexts. But it did force me to think, because it's definitely the way the post-game deal with this issue. But I started to think, like, is it just that we're following the Catholic Church because they were very prominent in terms of their directives of in medical ethics, and did the rabbis just get caught up in that approach, or is this intrinsic to Jewish approaches? Is this an indigenous Jewish approach, or have we been influenced? So the truth is, there are many sources that can be brought in this manner. I just brought a couple of them on the sheet because they're the ones that are quoted most frequently. But for example, you could say we have on the one hand the principle, the prohibition of lo tamod al dam riecha, you cannot stand idly by when someone's dying. There's also a prohibition against ritzicha. Ritzicha, we're never allowed to kill someone, but lo tamod al dam riecha, or to murder someone, lo tamod al dam riecha, there are times when you don't have to risk yourself to save a life. There could be such scenarios. Not common, but it could come up that you don't have to save a person who's dying if it's a lot of risk to yourself. So some have argued that there you see the distinction. You can't actively murder someone, but you don't always have to save them. That's one suggestion. Another one is Chayecha Kodmim, Rabbi Kiva, and the Kitonach HaShamayim, the story of Rabbi Kiva and Ben Petura, who are walking in the desert. Rabbi Kiva has with him the water. There's only enough for them to survive if only one of them drinks it. If they share it, they both die. So the Gemara says, Chayecha Kodmim, Chayecha Vercha, that Rabbi Kiva Paskin, you have the water, so you're allowed to drink your water. You can save it. However, the Gemara in Yuma Pei Bei says that if you are told either I'm going to kill you or you kill someone else, you have to rather be killed than kill another person. So what's the difference? Well, maybe this is exactly this, withholding versus withdrawing. You can say, if I already have it, I can keep it, but I can't proactively kill someone. Maybe that's the source. I saw one bioethicist, rabbi, write that the story of Yonah, that when he realizes, you know, the ship was happening because of him, that he asked to be thrown overboard, but he didn't jump. So maybe there's a difference. This is what this one argument was. There's a difference that he had said, someone else could throw me over, but I can't do it myself. He tried to argue that's the source for the concept of withholding versus withdrawing. Some others, many others, have argued the story of Rabbi Chananya ben Trajon is a source. It's been critiqued. The story of Rabbi Chananya ben Trajon, as you all read, Gemara Avodah Zarah, you know, he's dying. His students ask him, what he sees. He tells them that he sees the letters flying. And then they say to him, just open your mouth. Open your mouth and die. And he says, Mutav shidlenu misha nitna v'al yechbo hu be'atzmo. He would not do it himself. He said, rather let Hashem take me. So the executioner says to him, if I'm marbe b'shal heves, v'nosos hifugim shel tzemer mi'al libcham, and I take the wet wool off your heart to help you die faster, can you guarantee me olam haba? And he says, yes. But then here's the problem with this source. So then he does, miyad, hirbe b'shal heves, v'notol sifugin shel tzemer mi'al libo. So then the executioner actively does it. This is why many of the poskim have said this is not actually that good of a source for distinguishing between withholding and withdrawing, because the executioner did not just withhold, he withdrew. Maybe there's a difference between being Jewish and not Jewish. It's not obligated to follow halacha. Or maybe this was a unique case because it was a case of chilo Hashem and there was something unique there. But many have critiqued the source as actually being relevant for our discussion of withholding versus withdrawing. It's kind of a little bit of a problem. Yeah.
It's certainly relevant because he doesn't just withdraw the thing of prophets, stopping Benjamin from dying, but actually increases the flame.
Right, he kills him faster, and he jumps in, and he gets rewarded for it. So it doesn't seem to be, and that's why I put it here intentionally, because I did want to problematize it a little bit. Even though some postgame, and I've seen this written, use this as a source that we distinguish between withholding and withdrawing. Because it seems to be that Rav Chanan ben Trajan himself did have some kind of distinction there, but it's hard to understand the executioner's actions. Yeah.
Hi, this is Dvir, for those at home. I think on one hand, it's much more relevant, because out of all the sources that we have, this is the only one that actually speaks to the patient's consent, and like, uh-huh. Hey, we have proxy consent, like that whole language does not appear in, or like, to a certain extent, maybe with the ghost who says please move me, but
right,
the fact that there's like this contractual conversation being had about it,
uh-huh.
Says like that if the desire of the person truly is to expedite the process, then we should respect that. It's less of a source because it's like agadita, and how much
right.
Do we put on it enough?
Right. So very interesting. Great points. So speaking of agadita, there is a problem, right? With all these sources, we've used so much agadita. It's a problem, and it's an advantage, because it's a great thing about Chazal that we have these stories that we can analyze, and they can develop principles from them, and we can flesh them out to try to use for modern day questions, because the rabbis wouldn't have necessarily imagined respirators, but they can give us stories that we can apply in modern day cases. But there is an agadita that is quoted by the poskim, by the Rishonim. It's quoted a lot. The classic story of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi and his death, and the Amsa of the Bei Rebbe, who she was, we know from other stories in the Gemara, a very wise woman. And she was there with him in the house. So this is also relevant in terms of the experience, because Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was suffering. His students wanted him to live. They were davening for him to live. She was also davening for him to live. But then she saw, in fact, if you look at the words, it says, Kivan de Chazai. Once she saw, come as zimne de ayel lebesa kise. How many times he got up and had to go to the bathroom? So he was in a lot of pain and suffering, and she saw it. She was with him, and she realized he's suffering. The students are outside. They're davening out in the street. They didn't see what he's going through. And it made her change her prayer. And she says, I realize, you know what? It's better for him to go and let him die. So then she has to actually smash the jug to stop them from praying. She could have put a pillow over his face. I mean, she didn't do that. She lets him die. But there is an action she does by having them stop from praying. The question is, was their prayer the respirator? But she has them stop praying, and it works. And she actually does pray for him to die, and he dies. And the Ran, which Reb Moshe then quotes, the Ran says that you learn from this that sometimes it's appropriate to pray for someone to die. And from this we see you can have compassion for people who are dying, and recognize that we don't always have to have an approach where we say we have to do everything at all costs, all times, to save a life, to prolong life. There's times when you can have compassion for someone who's suffering in the dying process, and even pray for them to die. There's even stories where Rav Avadya Yosef brings a story that he actually had like a little bit of nusach, and there's times when he gathered a minyan at a patient's bedside to pray for them to die. So it's a real thing. Rav Moshe quotes this, and he says, okay, you see from here a stream of thought, and he says that this we can now bring as a halachic issue. And the main thing, I'm glad I saw a lot of you going through the whole piece from Igros Moshe there, because it's a very important piece. But the main thing that I wanted you to see there is at the very end, when he says, he's talking about these patients who are dying, he says, people who have no chance of survival. They're in a dying process. And they can't even live like this without much pain. You could just give them some kind of medications to prolong their life. And they're going to stay in this pain. You should just leave them as they are. This is the withholding versus withdrawing. He's saying, don't do something active, but you can passively allow them to remain like that. To give them something to make them die faster. We'll talk about this tomorrow when we talk about physician aid and dying. To actually kill them. To even shorten their life by a moment. That's murder. But we have a concept of sheva al tase, of im ikasame marpe, shiakilu hayasurim velo yikatsu af rega michai. But if you can give them some kind of pain medication, then sorry chlasos kishadayin enu gosis. Then you can give them pain medications. But he clearly has this distinction between allowing natural death versus causing it to happen faster. He mentions there in that piece the concept of the respirator. That's the next piece. I'll save for that one. But he also has this concept of, we didn't maybe even need to go to all these Gemaras. We have the concept of sheva tase, sheva tase adif. Maybe this is like trolleyology. You know, the classic trolley problem, which comes up a lot in halacha as well. You have the trolley going down the tracks, and it's going to kill a person who's sleeping on the tracks, and you're there at the switch, and you can turn the lever and divert the train, but then you realize that if you divert, I'm sorry, there's like five people on the track that are going to get killed right now. You can divert the train, but if you divert it, you save those five, but you're going to kill one person who's on that track. So you might say it's better to only one person die, but then again, it's your action. So what do we say? What do we say? And this came up a lot, whether it was in triage during the pandemic. Truth is, I just saw Rav Zilberstein had a shayla that some soldiers in Gaza were in a building, and one soldier went up to a higher floor to use the restroom, and then a number of Hamas militants came in through the top floor, and they were up on the top while the other guys were on the bottom. They wanted to know, can they call in a strike to take out the top floors of the building? But they knew that one of their guys is up there. That was the question he was asked. And the answer is based on, so this question, the Sheva Al-Tasa, that question, trolleyology, there's a classic Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, I know that the case that he had was someone who was driving down a hill in a truck, and as they're going down the hill, they realize that their brakes had gone out. And they are going to smash into a small car at the bottom of the hill. So they realize, I better divert the truck. And just as they realize it's time to divert the truck, they see a pedestrian there. The pedestrian's one. The car is full of a whole family. They want to know what they should do. So the Chazon Ish answers based on the Gemara of Netiyas Achetz, of diverting an arrow. If you could put up a shield to block an arrow as it's being shot at someone, but you can't block the arrow, you can only divert it. And somehow the arrow is going to kill five people. But if you divert it, it'll only kill one. But it's an action. So should we say, as many said, Sheva Tase is always better in ethics. If I have to choose between I'm killing a person or I'm just doing nothing and I'm just letting them die, should I just let them die? He actually paskin that it's not a maisa hariga, it's not an action of killing them, it's a maisa hatsala. You're doing an action of saving life, and therefore it's allowed. So we don't always just say sheva al tase is better. Sometimes there's an action that does more good than an inaction.
I just feel generally about sheva al tase, it's a play of words, because it's an active decision not to do something.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know, what do you say about an educator, if they're kids that are doing something, you don't do anything about it, that's an action. That says something to everybody.
Uh-huh.
Or in the army, right, your soldiers are misbehaving, you're not doing it, that's a clear uh-huh. saying. So it's like, to me, it's always, it's a problem of, it's a play of words uh-huh. for me sometimes. Sheva al tase is I decided, I'm Yoshev and I'm not, and uh-huh. like, you know, it's uh-huh. a general question about Sheva al tase.
Right.
This is Nehemiah.
Right. But,
what?
Yeah, your name is Nehemiah. But sometimes there's cases. There's cases that really challenging cases when both choices, ethically, if you look at them, they're equal. You cannot see one as really being better. But there, so then when it's either do something or do nothing, but they're both maybe not good ramifications, but you don't see one as being better. So then we say, all else being equal, you know what? I'd rather do nothing that's bad than do something that's bad.
But, and I think, again, it's Nehemiah. I think the real time where it becomes a challenge is, especially in end of life. And I mentioned this yesterday. Again, it's very, very hard to speak about it. But when you're in the ICU and you're prolonging somebody to live. Where they can't recover anything, but they're taking a hospital bed, and your Shevan Al Tasa over here, it could be like a Ritzicha for somebody else who might be able to survive.
Right.
And that has and
right.
And
to take it all into account, for sure. Yes, for sure. Yeah. Excellent. Very good. Yeah. Great. Sarah.
So I have two questions. One is like when he says Aim Tain Lo Mine Refuot, so that seems like it's actually maybe even saying we should not or we should prohibit prolonging the life of someone who is suffering kind of unnecessarily when, you know, we don't actually have a way to make them better, which I don't think that's how most, we have this sort of idea of autonomy that if people want to continue an aggressive treatment that will prolong their life by another week, even though it's going to cause suffering, that we do let people choose that. And my other question is the idea that we can give them pain medication, but we can't shorten their life. But my understanding is that most of the pain medications that we can give are not risk-free, right? Like, we give them aggressive pain medication in order to relieve their suffering, and, like, we are going to damage their kidneys, and they are going to live less long because of the pain medication.
Right, right. Good questions. And regarding your first question, we're going to come to it in our analysis of the Ramah. I think it's going to help us, and I'll keep that in mind. It's going to help us to analyze that. And you're right with the pain medications, there could be negative ramifications. There could be positive ramifications as well. So, like, obviously, we have to be taking into account every single possibility that might result in our actions. So it's definitely something to keep in mind. Excellent point. And we'll keep these in mind as we move forward. So, and also, by the way, in addition to the issue of Sheval Tassi, there's just issues of grama in halacha. So, like, there's a lot of halachic issues that we can be thinking about that might not just be trying to fit these stories into the categories, but yeah.
I was a little confused at where Rav Moshe, maybe it's in the part of the Shiva that we don't have in front of us, but where Rav Moshe, like, creates this distinction, because it doesn't seem to come out of either of the sources that he cites here. Right? Meaning it doesn't seem to me like the source, like the story of Rebbe is a helpful story to distinguish between withdrawal versus withholding, and this distinction that he makes between Sheva Al Ta'asid isn't borne out in the Rebbe story, in that story she's doing active things, she's at least removing the impediment,
right,
as well as actively davening that he should die,
right,
And similarly, in the, what was the other case he quoted, the Rebbe, something, Dimi case?
Yeah, Rav Dimi is based on the previous source that you can sometimes be allowed to doubt for someone to die.
Right. So in either case, you're actually doing something active to hasten the person's death.
Right, depending on how you see that, the tefillah. I mean, in this tshuva, he's... Tefillah, yeah.
Meaning the story of Rebbe proves that tefillah is effective, right? Meaning If the story of Rebbe is a source that you can do hasarat hamuneya because the tefillah is effective in stopping Rebbe from dying, then her tefillah that Rebbe should die should also be treated as being an effective action.
Right. I think
either tefillah is an action or it's not an action.
Yes. Very good. And it is in certain. So in this tshuva, he's only really his primarily based on Amsa Debe Rebbe and the story of the death of Rebbe. But it's because it gives him a value. We're talking about, you know, that we're using Agadah to hear. Part of the benefit of it is that it's not just that it's a halacha. It's not a halacha psuka. It's not like we have a sif in the Shulchan Aruch. But it's values. And it's, we can talk about Jewish values. So he's saying, look, we see that there is such a thing as a value of allowing someone to die. We don't see here that you have to do everything you can to prolong life at all costs. There's times when you can allow death to occur. So that's all he's getting from this source. But then he also is going to use the Rama in other tshuvas that informs it, and that's the Rama that we're coming to, where you see the distinction more clearly, at least in the way he reads it, which we'll see one more piece from Ramosha. So let's go there. Let's do that now, because this Rama is the most important piece, and so let's do it thoroughly, including the source that the Rama is based on, which is the Shulti Yiborim. The Shulti Yiborim is based on the Sefer Chassidim. The Sefer, and a lot of this is going to depend on how you see these interactions that they're doing. So, and I'll share with you some suggestions that I've heard, and I heard some really interesting ones as I walked around the room as well earlier. So the Sefer Chassidim writes as follows. Ein gormim la'adam shelo yamus mehera. We should not, you know, indirectly slow down a person's dying process. Kagon, shehaya echad goses. Someone's a goses, which means they're in the dying process. Their body is actively shutting down. They're dying shortly. Vaya echad karov le'oso bayis chotev etzim. And someone is nearby chopping wood. And it's either the rhythm of the wood or the noise. Something of the chopping is preventing them from dying. And so the soul can't leave. And just, by the way, I'll just say it here since it came up. Rav Moshe, this also comes, this same phrase comes up in the Rama. Rav Moshe saw this as being a spiritual reality. That Ein HaNeshama Yechol Etzeis means the neshama wants to go. There comes a time, just like we say, you know, Ba'kor Chachata Chai, Ba'kor Chachata Meis, you're born against your will, you die against your will, but there comes a time when your soul wants to leave. And it's causing spiritual pain to force your soul to stay in the body when it's trying to go.
I just want to remind, it's Rabbi Reznikoff, I just want to remind people that Beth Pepper yesterday described a nurse telling her that often it happens that people who are close to death will not die if their loved ones are in the room, but if you'll just step out of the room and give them permission, then they'll go, and indeed that is what happened with her mother.
It's a thing. We see it. We notice it a lot in the hospital, actually. Yeah. But Rav Moshe's concern here is that, like, maybe there's even an isser. This is where we get, like, maybe it's even prohibited to force the neshama to stay in the body longer than it wants to. Because when it's trying to go, he says, you can't kill the person to make it go. I mean, first of all, how do we really know when this neshama is trying to leave? I mean, you can't know for sure. The neshama doesn't talk to us. But you can have an impression that the neshama is trying to leave. And if we're holding it down, we're actually causing pain to the neshama. So therefore, it's the wrong thing to do. Not just that we should say, like, oh, maybe what's so bad. But it's actually wrong to force the neshama to stay in a body when it's trying to leave. There's spiritual pain. And I talk about this a lot with patients and what this means. And so anyways, he says, so the soul can't leave because of this wood chopper somehow keeping it in. So he says, Masiri Malchotev Misham. You can actually remove that. You can tell the wood chopper, stop chopping the wood. Again, you're not killing the person, but you're saying you're removing the impediment. Vein Masimim Melach al Lashono Kadesh Shelo Yamus. And we don't put salt on the tongue to prevent them from dying. We have to talk about the salt. Somehow, the person who's dying, the wood chopper's outside chopping wood. And we can tell the wood chopper, you know what, stop chopping, their soul's trying to leave. But we don't say, similarly, we don't say, don't put salt on the tongue to keep them alive. Vim goseis omer eini yachol lamus, and then if they're dying and they say, I can't die, ad shesimuhu b'mokom acher, they say, you know what, I can't die here, move me, move my body, move. And this is obviously, especially, you can imagine, in nowadays, in a hospital bed, and we were talking before about a case where I've had cases where patients were in the category of goseis, presumably, they were really dying, and we moved them to another room, and in the transport across the hospital, they died, because it can be a little bit jarring, you know, going over the bumps and the elevators. And you can imagine, what was it like in the times of Sefer Chassidim to move a person? I mean, obviously, they weren't just moving them, rolling them on rolling beds. They were probably picking them up and moving them. And he says, that, though, as much as we want to respect the patients, you know, the fact that they want to die, we're not going to move them. That's too much, especially considering that the Gemara in Smachos says that a person who's dying is a ghost, is like a flickering flame, and just putting your finger, you know, moving them is like putting your finger on the flame, hastening their death. So now, this source becomes really important in the Shulti Giborim, because he tells it as a story. I love this, how it's like a narrative. So the Shulti Giborim, talking about this concept that we don't touch a ghost. So that's where he's coming from. So he says, Mikan hayanir, if we're not supposed to touch a ghost to make them die faster, nir lesor mashinogim ksasanashim. So it seems there's this custom in Italy where he lived in the 16th century, that they would pull the pillow out from under their head. Now you would think, oh, it's killing them by pulling the pillow out, like it makes their head flop down, and that's what kills them. But that was not what was happening. They somehow believed that Kadesh Yomus Meir, why? Sheomrim ki yesh b'mita notzos shel ofos shegormim lenefesh lo teitze. Somehow these goose feather pillows, whatever, they believe that it was like holding the soul in. And presumably these were not the pillows that everyone would sleep with. It was like some kind of medicinal thing that a doctor in those times would say like, oh, the person's dying, let's give them this pillow. Then they won't die. Because that pillow somehow kept them alive.
They didn't have pillows, they just had pillows.
No pills, just pillows. Very good. And even if we think this sounds ridiculous, let's just try to put ourselves in like, because you know what? There's going to be people in 100 or 300 years from now, they're going to look at our medicine, and they're going to think that we're ridiculous, right? In a lot of ways, right? But let's just try to tease out the principles. What are the principles we can extract from this? So you can't take out the pillow, because the pillow was put there to keep them alive. But I see they're doing this. Yes, so I see that they are putting this there. The kamap amim sa'akti kekruchia. So many times I yelled out la'asir amin agara v'lo ala biyadi, and I wasn't able to convince them to stop this. For abosai chilku alai, and my rabbis disagreed with me. V'harei nasan ish igra kasaval zeh lahatir, and the rabbis were allowing it. So what could I do? Until I found the Sefer Chasidim. Then I found the source, Achar Kama Yami Matsasi B'Sefer Chasidim, in this that we just read, where he writes. So therefore he says, Emes Ki Sefer Chasidim Tzarech Iyun. The truth is, I'm not totally understanding the Sefer Chasidim, as many of you asked. Ki B'Tchila Kasash Im Haya Ish Echad Gosis Haya Echad Karv L'Oso Bayis Chotev Eitzim. First he said, if someone is chopping wood near the Gosis, V'Neshom Yechol Latzeis Masina Chotev Misham. You can top the wood chopper. Wait a second, why can you stop the wood chopper, but you can't remove the pillow? No, there is a difference, though, between removing the pillow and stopping the wood chopper. And here's the answer. To do an action. To cause them not to die quickly, so that would be prohibited. Kagon lachtov etzim sham kadeshi tis akevan shama letzeis, or the sum melech al shono, or to put the salt on their tongue kadeshi lo yamos meir to prevent them from dying. Kol ze asur kadamashma sham milashono v'chol ki yotze b'ze shari lahasir hagramahu aval lasos davar shiyigro misaso, but to actually do something to make them die meheira faster. That's why we can't move the ghosts, because somehow that's an action. That's moving them. They also thought that putting the keys to the shul. Actually, there's different girsas. There's some who argue that means the keys to the cemetery. Beis HaKnesses was actually missing maybe Beis HaKvaros. And that's why it was causing them to die faster. Either way, his distinction is that there's between an action and an inaction. Lefize concludes, Im yesh davar shegorim lenasher shelo teitze, then mutar lahasir. You can remove an impediment. That also gorim ve'ein b'kachlum. That's nothing, because you just removed the impediment. Why? Shehare eino maniach etzba'o al haner. You didn't put your finger on the flame. Ve'eino ose maisen. You didn't do an action. That's his keyword. No maisa. Aval. La niach davar ala goseis. But to put something onto the goseis. Or the talta mimakum lamakum. To move the goseis around. Kadesh teitze nishmaso mehera. To make him die faster. Nira devade asur deha maniach etzbao ala nir. Because that's putting your hand on the flame. And therefore that is prohibited. So he's distinguishing between action and inaction.
Hi. This is Dvir. He decidedly chooses to kind of say act like that, to speak about it as doing an action versus not doing an action, and the action that is gorem towards, like, to cause someone to die. But like reading these sources, you could have really said like moving a pillow is like kind of physically moving their body.
Right.
Zoos, like moving them from one place to another is like moving and touching their body. But because he's like speaking about it as actions that cause death as opposed to touching body, that could like open up a whole other set of prohibitions that would be even like therapies that are helping someone at an end of life, that could be even helping them to live. But like reading these sources, I could have easily drawn the conclusion that I'm not allowed to touch a body who's close to death at all in fear of causing the death. But know.
Well, that is true. Yeah. That is the halacha. I mean, for a therapeutic touch, we often allow it, but in general, we're not supposed to touch a goses because we're afraid that we might hasten their death. It can be a big, very challenging issue, but yeah. Yes.
Hi, Adam. I'm surprised to see that. I feel like he's distinguishing between two types of actions,
uh-huh.
as opposed to distinguishing between action and inaction.
Right, yes.
Saying actions can actually be okay if you are removing an impediment.
Yeah.
That is an action.
Yeah.
That is a further step than just saying, Shevardt.
It's an action, but somehow it's not a Misa. If there's a difference, right? Right.
You are doing
right. Something. You're doing something, but it's only removing an impediment. It's not an action that's hastening death.
Yeah.
Somehow we distinguish between the two, right? And this was their medicine, right? Clearly, this was their medicine. It was some kind of segula, something mystical. But I'll tell you some theories in a second. I think there was one more.
Could you look at it more as an agrama, as in your? Like there's processes in the middle versus to take the, like, for example, take the melach off the lips. That's very much you're doing the actual pulia.
Right. That's how the Tzitz Eliezer takes it. Some of the poskim say it's the issue is the grama, the causation, and it's grama just very similar to Hilchos Shabbos, basically, or really nezikin, grama nezikin, which is problematic. So this source becomes like the key for medical ethics questions today. So let's just look at the Shulchan Aruch, and then I'm going to tell you some. Let's start talking. We'll start talking about some practical ramifications and some theories, and you can sort of see why this becomes so relevant, especially because we can do so much more today than we could in the past. We have so many options. So we really this source might even be more relevant today than it ever was. So the Shulchan Aruch writes as follows. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I just want to point out a few key lines. So he starts off, the Shulchan Aruch himself says, "Goses harehu kechay l'chol devar." We treat a goses like being totally alive. Ein koshin l'chayev, ein sochino. So we don't prepare the funeral. We don't tie their, you know, tie their jaw or lubricate them. Ein madichino so, ein pokakin es nekava. We don't close up any holes. Ein shomti makar mitachtav. We don't close their eyes. We don't do anything until they die. That's preparing the funeral. We have to be extra cautious and careful how we treat someone who is a goses. The Ramah, which ends up really being the key source that we want to look at, the Ramah then summarizes that Shilta Giborim as follows. And the way he writes it is crucial. He says, V'chein aser ligrom l'meis shiyamus meheru. We can't cause someone to die faster. They're dying for a long time. Their soul just can't leave them. You can't just pull out the pillow. The same reason that we gave before. We can't move them. Here's where the debate comes up. The bet, hey, is that basic kinesis or basic kvaros, tachas rosho. And you don't remove the keys. Kadeshi Parade. I have a great time with I teach a medical ethics class in some high schools in LA, and I love putting this on the board and debating. Okay, so let's make our categories. Let's make a chart. So what can't we do? What we can't do is remove the pillow, right? Or put the keys to the shul or the cemetery under their head. However, so that's what we can't do. Aval im yesh Sham davar shegorem ikuv yitzis nefesh. But something's preventing their soul from leaving. There's a sound. This wood chopper. Now this is another column. The wood chopper, you can stop. Or sheyesh melech al shono, or there's salt in their tongue. Ve'elu me'akvim yitzis nefesh, and they prevent their soul from leaving. Mutar la'asir misham. De'ein b'zeh ma'isa klal. That's not an action. Ela shemeser amoneya. So we have the salt and the wood chopper. That's allowed. The moving the body, the pillows, and the keys, not allowed. So what is the difference? Why can we allow some and not others? So it seems to be that there's a maisa involved, even though, as you pointed out, there's some action with all these things. There's some action happening. So, and also, the salt, I kind of get it when it comes to the wood chopper. The wood chopper is very external. It's outside. It's far away. It's just a noise. I'm not touching the person. I'm not like really handling their body. It's just a noise. So, but the salt, it's touching them. So it kind of complicates things by saying the salt you can move. Why can I move the salt and not the pillow? That becomes even more complicated. In fact,
but according to the Sefer Hasidim, it says in mesimin melacha leshono.
Yeah.
Put it on, so it's like not giving a medication to prolong.
Yes,
life.
Yes, and we're going to come to that. It changed the focus, but it's the same purpose, which we'll come back to in a second. Because the first time I brought this up with the posek, and I said, I'm confused about the Taz. The Taz doesn't make sense. He says, you're right. Ignore the Taz. We don't. I'm confused about the salt. The salt doesn't make sense here. So he said, you're right. Ignore the salt. The salt, take it out. Like, how can we take it out? It's in the Ramah. He says, yeah, look in the Taz. Look at the Taz. The Taz there said, No, we don't. It doesn't fit in with the rest. It was either for a segula. It's not part of our concern. So just ignore. Erase the taz. I mean, erase the salt from there. That's one way to deal with it.
If we were to read this sugya, doubling down on the like negiya aspect of it, then it would make perfect sense. The salt, like, don't put salt on them, because now you're...
Because you're touching them, right. So the shach there says, part of why he says it's allowed, he says, Yeshlomer denanua kal kaze lav klumu. It's so gentle, which, okay, hopefully it's gentle, but I mean, it's on their tongue, it's like in their face. It's a kind of, but yeah, if it's very gentle, but you're right, it doesn't fit.
I think something that kind of confused us, that you clarified that it's purely for a segula, because if anything, the salt seems to be the one that has the most logic to it. That's the one, you know, making sure someone has sodium
yes.
makes a lot of sense. So you have to kind of remove modern
right.
science.
Right. Okay. So I'll tell you. So most understand this as all talking about segulas. We don't understand it. We're trying to understand principles from it. We don't understand the actions they were doing. This is my issue. I love medical halacha. This is my life. So whenever I can, I love learning more. So my hospital has been so kind to send me to Israel a number of times just to go to the hospitals there and spend time in the hospitals with their rabbis. And my second most recent trip last summer, I went and I spent a day with Rav Hoffner at Mayanei HaYeshua. Mayanei HaYeshua is in Bnei Brak. It's a Haredi hospital. That's what it's known for. It's the Haredi hospital. And their posek, Rav Hoffner, is a really amazing, interesting person and very kind person. Is very generous with his time. So I spent the whole day with him. And as Dr. Prager was saying this morning, like brain death isn't that common. He said it's like 10, 15 cases a year. I was saying in my hospital, it's the same, about 10 or 15 cases a year. I was with him for one day. In one day, he had 5 brain death cases. In one day. And I said to him at the end of the day, I was like, not even at the end of the day, I was like, wow, this is a lot. He goes, oh, before you got here this morning, I had 2 more before you got here. So first of all, I understand why they have so many brain death cases. It's because, that's known as the hospital where you send someone if you want them to do everything they can to keep them alive. And since they're not withdrawing anything, they're going to end up to the point of being brain dead. But what I noticed was that every time we went into a room where a patient was declared dead by neurological criteria, he said to the nurses, okay, remove all the pressures, blood pressure medications, remove everything, take it out, and let them die faster. So at a certain point, I was like, Rabbi Hoffner, I just ask, I'm really surprised what you're doing. In our hospital, we would never do that. If a patient doesn't accept brain death, we would allow the medications to run out, the pressors, the blood pressure medication, we allow it to run out, you know, passively, and then not refill the bag, but we would never just actively take it out. And one thing he told me, and I'll maybe tell you a few stories over our time together, he always mentions, like, you know, we're not looking for kulas here. This is Bnei Brak. We're not looking for Yerushalmi kulas. That's remember how he told me that once. We don't look for Yerushalmi kulas. When I would ask him, like, Rav Shlomo Zalman, he's like, no, we don't need Yerushalmi kulas. But I was like a little surprised. You know, this seems active. You're just removing everything. They're not killing them, but they remove the pressure, they remove everything, and then the patient, their heart stops shortly thereafter. And so I asked him, I was like, can you explain this to me? He goes, what do you mean? What's surprising? This is the melach mi'al lashono. This is the salt on the tongue. The blood pressure medication, the pressors, most often when a patient is dying and they progress to brain death, the brain is no longer telling them to breathe. And their heart is also, the blood pressure is not being maintained in their heart. So the respirator keeps them breathing. The blood pressure medications keep their blood pressure up. So without those, they usually can't survive their brain dead. So the blood pressure medication, he says, that was the salt. Why did they put salt on the tongue? They noticed, and the truth is, it is true, in many times that sodium, a lot of salt, can increase her blood pressure. I myself, in the last year,
sodium.
I've been trying to have a low salt diet. I'm not like so, and I've eaten a lot less salt than I used to. And every now and then, like either I'll accidentally or intentionally, you know, just eat something very salty, and my heart starts racing, and I feel it. I feel like, oh wow, like this really is impacting me. And the truth is, they weren't doctors like we are today, but they did have a knowledge of the human body, right? They did have intimate knowledge of the human body, and it could be that they knew that salt, and that's why when you mentioned the Sefer Chassidim, he said it the other way. He said, don't put salt once they're already dying. Well, what do you mean? What was the salt for? Clearly, it seems to be that the salt was a medical intervention to keep their blood pressure up, because they knew, maybe they didn't call it blood pressure, maybe they didn't know that it was blood pressure, but they knew that people, when they're dying and their body's shutting down, salt could be a process by which we could keep it going. So he said, it's clear from the Ramah that you're allowed to remove these things in a gosase. At least they see brain death as a gosase, right? So he said, that's why we remove it. So I asked a number of poskim afterwards, because I thought that was brilliant, to be honest. I was like, wow. And I'd never seen it in writing anywhere. And he told me that the poskim in Bnei Brak that he consults with agreed with him. I asked other poskim. Everyone I asked did not agree. In fact, some of them angrily disagreed. I was surprised to see this kula in Bnei Brak. One poskim said, it's not a kula, it's a mistake. That's what one told me. But it's interesting, because the other said, no, it's a segula, we don't understand the salt, we shouldn't be making nafkaminas in the salt based on what we think it was there for. No one says it was there for that. But the truth is, look at the Beis Lechem Yehuda, an Acharon, that when he writes this, he says, what's the whole thing with the salt? Just look at the second line. It says, Al korchach nimsa shemitchila asu shelo kahogen. It must be that they put it there for the wrong reason. Shehayamaniach hamelech alashono, they put the salt there, but now they realized it's not helping. As long as they are very careful not to move them, it must be that the reason why you can remove it is because you put it there in order to do something that you realize maybe deploying their life, and you realize it's not happening. Which is why, by the way, and now we should start talking about, and I'll mention respirators first and go to questions, and I'll tell you some other interventions, but how do we apply all this to respirators? And most poskim, the vast majority, say the respirator is, because the question would be, now that we have the chart, if they have it in your mind, but this is how I do it in my classes. You have in your chart, you have the salt and the wood chopper, and you have the pillow, the movement, and the keys, and the other. And now I just start going through it. Okay, let's talk about different interventions, which goes in which side. I ask my students, which is the respirator? And the truth is, it's usually 50-50 split. Half can see, you know what? The respirator is clearly the pillow. Like it was put there. To, you know, it's there to prolong the life. It's there. You remove it, they die right away. Others say no. The respirator is the wood chopper, and therefore you can remove it. And this is what some poskim, very few, but like Rav Chaim David Alevi said, and then quoting this Beis Lechem Yehuda, he said the respirator is certainly the wood chopper. And if it was put there, and he argues that the salt is being put there later as the person's dying, as the last-ditch effort to keep them alive and save their life. Maybe they're not terminal. Maybe they can be saved. So you put the salt there to try to save them, and hopefully they'll have a miraculous recovery. But then if you see, nope, they're still dying, you realize, okay, we tried it, but it didn't. It wasn't effective, and so you can remove it. So he quoted that, and he said, since the respirator is the wood chopper, and it was put there, like the salt, save the life, but now the life can't be saved, you can remove it. Sorry?
The Ramah's going to disagree, because the Ramah's going to say it has to be not touching.
Yeah, so many, many poskim argue that it's touching because it's in their mouth. Like, it's in their body. The respirator goes into their mouth and then down into their lungs. So, through their trachea. So, it's... But then again, is it being removed or turned off? We can talk about some of the distinctions, but maybe the respirator is just too much in the body. It's too much connected. It's too much, involves too much touching. In fact, that's what the Tzitzit Eliezer said, exactly that point. He said, to remove the respirator, it's so invasive. That's the pillow. That's not the wood chopper.
Could we also make a distinction of the wood chopper and the salt being things that don't actually have a medical reality? Like, if Rav Moshe is saying that the wood chopper is about the spiritual reality, then like wouldn't that be a good nafgamina for this? Like, you can remove things that like don't actually change a physical medical reality, but if there's something that is changing a medical reality, you have to keep it once it's there. And that's maybe where the plus thing comes in too. It's like, depending on where you are in the process, it may be okay or not okay to initiate.
Interesting. It seems to me that Ramosha thought that, yeah, the soul wanting to leave is a metaphysical reality, but that something's happening medically with these interventions. I mean, it is either hastening death or preventing death or causing death. I mean, that's the whole question, by the way. We'd be careful in semantics. You know, we need to talk about allowing natural death, causing death, do it killing versus letting die. This is why, by the way, just as a side point, but it's relevant here, when we talk about DNRs, do not resuscitate, a lot of times when people hear that phrase, it's shocking, because basically it's saying we can resuscitate, but we want to say we are not going to do what we can do. Because why? Because it's saying do not resuscitate. But if you're, it sounds like you can, meaning I could resuscitate, but I'm not going to. So oftentimes we like to say allow natural death is a better way of saying that phrase. Because in cases where a person cannot be resuscitated, so in our hospital they change it to DNAR, do not attempt resuscitation, to try to convey the message that it's an attempt at resuscitation, but it's not a guarantee. But I kind of like the allow natural death. I mean, sometimes the point comes where it's allowing. But this is the semantics of all this. What's allowing death? What's causing death? What's hastening death? What's killing? What's allowing to die? To be careful how we talk about it. But also, I'll just give one more example. The respirator, you know, that is one level of intervention. Just yesterday, actually, I was telling someone that the topics I was going to talk about, I was at a bioethics conference in Arizona, and I mentioned this topic. So this was a bioethicist. He says to me, oh, I disagree with the distinction between withholding and withdrawing. I think that there's no distinction. That's a religious thing. It's not an ethics thing. It's not a philosophically justified. So he said, I think that the respirator is more like the wood chopper. The respirator is not an action. It's just, you know, you're allowing them to rely on their own lungs. And if their lungs can't sustain life, so then they're dying. It's not the respirator removal is killing them. So you could make that case. Although on the other, the counter argument would be, if they were going to be alive, but your action resulted in death in a very short time after you did it, is there some kind of grama involved? Like if it's almost immediate, so like it's hard to argue that it's not connected somehow. But my response then was, okay, that's respirators. What about TAH, total artificial hearts? One thing we have in our hospital, I know there are many hospitals, is patients waiting for heart transplant. Oftentimes they don't have a lot of time. They need a heart. They're going to die. So they've developed artificial hearts as a bridge to transplant. And what they do is they actually remove a patient's heart completely. They remove their heart and they put in a plastic heart. And the plastic heart beats for them and serves as a heart. And the question, unfortunately, those don't always last to transplant. Either there's infections that develop, or let's say the patient develops some kind of condition that makes them no longer a candidate for a transplant. And a certain point comes where they have to say to the patient, like, you're suffering, you're declining, and there's nothing else we can do for you. So can you turn them off? Because you're literally turning the patient off. And I've had the experience as a chaplain of being with patients. Literally, they'll go like, can I just go for a walk with my family first and then you'll turn me off? Like, they're totally alive. And they literally get turned off and then they're dead immediately. Usually they're put to sleep first just because of the experience. But so I asked this person, my interlocutor yesterday. So he was saying, I don't think a respirator, you know, that's not, you know, I don't think it's a problem of withdrawing just because, you know, withdrawing, I don't like the distinction. So I said, how about artificial hearts where you're literally turning the person off? He thought about it. He said, I see it there. Yeah, now I see it. Because it's not just saying, let the person go back to rely on their heart function. They don't have heart function. So you're turning them off, literally. So here's another one. Interesting one. Dialysis. Dialysis, for a person, there's two types of dialysis. There's continuous renal replacement therapy, CRRT, which is ongoing, constant dialysis. But there's also dialysis, the more common type, where it's cyclical. So every couple of days, a person will have a dialysis treatment, and that will filter their blood because their kidneys aren't working, and then they start the next treatment the next day or a few days later. So if a person is dying and suffering and there's no more cure, can we stop dialysis in between cycles? this is where you really get to the withholding versus withdrawing distinction. Because normally we would say, yeah, in between cycles, you're not withdrawing, you're just withholding the next cycle. Interestingly, when I spent some time at Shaar HaTzedek Medical Center in Yerushalayim, we had a case like this, and I saw that the rabbi there didn't allow them to stop dialysis. And I was surprised. I asked him why. He said, because we follow Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach here. Rosh Shlomo Zalman had a psak that after a certain amount of time, the dialysis becomes considered that it's the kidneys. The dialysis is the kidneys. So stopping dialysis is removing the kidneys. When I was at Mayanei HaYeshua, I saw they had a case where they stopped the dialysis. In fact, I'll show you just real one source, and then I'll go ahead and see your questions. Rav Moshe, based on all this that we just read, Rav Moshe has a fascinating piece, and I'll tell you two stories based on this. Rav Moshe quotes all this, and he says, "Kol zman shemechona ovedes avodasa asura litol mipiv." That whole time that the respirator is working, you can't remove it from their mouth. Clearly, he sees the respirator not as the salt, as the salt or the wood chopper, but as the pillow or moving the body. Deshema hu chai viharge'u bezet. That's killing him. Aval. But what could you do? Kesha paskam mila'avod, once the respirator is not working, shenechzar ha oxygen, when it's out of chamsam, it's out of oxygen, shayasham lo yachziru lipiv od hapam ad avur zman katsar karevasha. You can wait time and not move it back to the mouth. Sheim eno chai kavar yafsik nilashono viyadu shahu mace. Now you see the person is dead. And you don't have to remove, you have to replace it. Many saw this as saying that, you know, the way respirators used to work was that there was a tank. And you just had the respirator and the tank right there. And the tank runs out sometimes. Or you have to remove the respirator to clean out the person's throat. So when they're anyways cleaning out their throat or replacing the tank, so you stopped for a medical reason. It had to. It ran out of oxygen. So just don't replace it. In fact, one time, I was in my office. A rabbi came by my office. We give out free validations for all clergy as a way to be nice and also to make sure they stop by our office. And he stops in my office and he, I just said, like, oh, what's going on? Who are you here to see? And this rabbi says to me, the patient you're seeing, and I knew it was an end-of-life patient. It was complicated. And he says, yeah, they called me in to ask about this. So I came to talk to the doctors and the family because it's a question of pulling the plug, as they call it, removing the respirator. So I said, oh, yeah, that's a hard case. I know that case. What are you going to say? He says, oh, it's not, I don't think it's so hard. I was like, oh, really? So, yeah, tell me. He goes, yeah, I'm just going to go up there and tell them that when the oxygen tank runs out, just don't refill it. It's simple. So I was like, are you serious? He was like, yeah, why? I was like, they're going to laugh at you. He was like, why? I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of the Torah. I'm not ashamed to say what the Torah says to do. I don't care if they laugh at me. I was like, no, it's not the Torah. They're not laughing chas v'shalom at the Torah, but they're going to laugh at you when you say to wait for the tank to be replaced because it doesn't work that way anymore. It's plugged into a wall. The tank, the oxygen is 24 hours, and they don't remove the endotracheal tube to clean it anymore. They can clean it while it's in. So this isn't the reality anymore. So I remember he gave me this look like a deer in the headlights. He was like, oh, what do I say then? I have no idea what to say. So I was just like, what? It was just like, this is the problem. I mean, Rav Moshe here is giving us a principle, but the application is no longer relevant. But the principle is, so when I asked at my name Yeshua and I saw that they did stop dialysis in between cycles. They didn't stop it. They no longer continued it. And I said to Rav Hofner, I said, how are you allowed to stop the dialysis? He says, what do you mean? It's in between cycles. This is Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe said, it stopped for any other medical reason, you don't have to restart it. It stopped for that reason. This is Rav Moshe's psak. And I said to him, oh, those Yerushalmi kulas in Yerushalayim, they won't stop it. They're more machmer than you. So he said, no, they're not more machmer. They're just wrong. The same answer the other guy gave me. But but you see, that's another application. I'll give you more, but I see there's some here.
What do you do with the respirator? Because it's connected to, you just...
The majority approach of the post game is that the respirator is more like the pillow than the wood chopper. I mean, I'll leave it to you to decide what you think makes the most sense. But if you want to follow the postgame, most say that if it's going to lead to death within a very short amount of time, which there's a big debate about what short amount of time means. Dr. Abraham published in his Sefer Nishmas Avraham that it means 2 days, maybe based on Yom or Yomayim, I don't know, but he says if they'll die within 2 days. That's very machmir. Many postgame have said it means within a few hours. I mean, if you extubate and they're going to die within a few hours, it's too proximal. It just feels too connected. That feels like it's an action. It's a maisa. And they felt that turning off a respirator in that case would not be allowed. However, there was some solution. So, for example, Dr. Steinberg, and then I'll mention Israeli law too. I know there's some people in Israel here too. Dr. Steinberg had a case with, actually it was the wife of President Navon from Israel, that she was dying for a long time. She was in the hospital on a respirator, and she wasn't dying. And they felt like this was indignity for her. She was just laying as a dying patient for so long, and they felt that it was some kind of suffering. In fact, we've seen it might be spiritual suffering. And they asked Dr. Steinberg, is there any way that we can take her off the respirator? They were not necessarily Da'ati, but they were Sephardi, and they wanted to ask a rabbi. And they said, is there any way that we can, within halacha, allow her to die? So he said, I don't know, let me ask Rosh Shlomo Zalman. He asked Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he said, you know, why don't you just turn the respirator down to the lowest setting that still keeps her alive? Gradually, just very carefully, the setting in terms of how much oxygen percentage and how much aggressively it's being pumped in. And as keep on turning it down, as long as she stays stable. If she's stable, you can turn it down even more. And then if she needs more, you don't have to turn it back up. So he said, okay, wow. He said, but you know what? Ask another posik. If anyone else agrees with me, then you could do it. So he asked Rav Vosner in Bnei Brak, and Rav Vosner agreed. And he said, but make sure that each time is very gentle, only a little bit. So they did that, and she gradually, they weaned her off basically the respirator, and she was on very low settings, and she died. After it, Dr. Steinberg went to Rosh Shlomo Zalman and said, this was a very important psak. This is not people don't know about this. Can I publish it? So he says, I'm afraid. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to get attacked for this. I don't know if I'm right. He said, well, actually, Rav Vosner agreed with you. So he said, yeah? Okay. So publish it in his name. So that's the story that he says. But that was another solution. By the way, just before it leaves my mind, this withdrawing versus withholding distinction is in Israeli law. Dr. Steinberg published the Israeli dying patient law. And in Israeli law today, there are protocols, and withdrawing is prohibited if it causes death within a few hours. There's different opinions, like we were saying, but if it causes immediate death. And actually, another story Dr. Steinberg says, just so I'm telling his stories, when they debated in the Knesset, you know, it was hard. They were passing this law that's based on halacha, but they had to write it in a way that makes sense with secular ethics, because Israel's not a religious state. They're not going to just pass laws for all Israelis to follow based on Orthodox halacha, unless it can make sense and they write it in a way that's carefully written that makes sense to everyone. Did I say something not clear?
Plenty of things that are according to Orthodox law.
Yeah. Okay, yes, true. But in the medical establishment, it's especially complicated. I mean, it's especially complicated. So, so they were trying to find, and by the way, they included Rav Eliashiv in this. We were talking about stories before. They had to find a way to have Rav Eliashiv agree and secular Israelis agree. So they were trying to thread the needle. So when they debated in the Knesset, he says that one of the far left secular Chavre Knesset said, you know, in America, they don't distinguish between withholding and withdrawing. So why should we distinguish between this? This feels archaic. So he said to her, and this is an important point, which I'll mention, and I promise I'm going to get to your question. He said to her, you know what? Maybe that's true. In fact, all my doctors at Shaar HaTzedek are not willing to pull the plug, so to speak. So if you feel that it's not a problem, if you won't mind, please come with me, because I have a lot of patients right now that, you know, they're dying, but they're being kept alive by the respirator. Could you please come with me to the hospital, and you'll be the one to take them all off the respirators, because none of the doctors will do it. And she said, no, I'm not going to do that. So he said, well, I rest my case then. If you're not willing to do it, because experientially there is a difference. Meaning this is part of the argument. Experientially it's different, even if it's not philosophically different. During COVID, for example, I promise I'm going to get to your... during COVID, there were those who were arguing often that, you know, when our respirators became all used up, our ICUs became all full, and there are those who are arguing that, you know, patients who have no chance of survival should make way for patients who do have a chance of survival. And so they started to implement those protocols in some places where they would terminally extubate patients, to take them off the respirator, who they thought had no chance to survive, let them die, and then give it to a patient who could survive. The problem they found was, you know, Dr. Prager mentioned this morning at the case of Karen Ann Quinlan, when the Supreme Court ruled that they could remove the respirator, do you know that in that hospital, no nurses were willing to do it? They had to bring in outside nurses. They had to find people that no one was willing to. Now it's totally commonplace. At that time in the 70s, no one would do it. So same thing, but then it happened again during COVID. The nurses felt, you know what? On the normal basis, I'm okay with removing, you know, interventions to allow someone to die. But now I don't feel like it's for their benefit, meaning it's not what they asked for. It's only for the benefit of the next patient. I don't feel comfortable with it. And once again, there became a lot of like moral trauma related to extubation at the end of life, because experientially it might be different than philosophically. But halakhically, we see that there does seem to be some distinction. I'll give you some more examples, but I'm going to hear your comments. You had your up hand for a while.
It's tied. Maybe this is a good segue into my comment, which is that it seems to me like we're talking in circles. And like, just your medical ethics class is a good example, right? Is the ventilator like this, like the pillow, or is it like the or is it like the salt? And you get 50-50 results. 50-50 of the intuitions go this way and go that way.
Right.
And we have the Taz versus the Nikunas Akesiv. You have these different the Mayanei Yeshua versus all the other poskim in Bnei Brak. You have the Tzitzeliezer versus Rashi. Actually, the distinction is not halachic, not philosophic, not moral, not ethical. It's aesthetic. I don't want to be the person who kills another human being. And actually, the distinction between withdrawal and withholding. Actually, there's nothing there because the intuitions go 50-50 each way every time. They're just split down the middle. And that shows you that there's not a real distinction here. It's just aesthetic.
Interesting.
I want to be the person who, if I want to be the nurse who takes.
Is that not relevant though? Is that not valid? I mean, if it feels like it's killing when you're doing the action, then might there be something to that then? Is there like a moral intuition?
If my aesthetic opinion is withholding a person who's in suffering, who's in pain, and the best thing for this person is to move on from this life. Yes, I think that my aesthetic holdup makes is a moral problem.
I hear you. I mean, this is part of why the postgame there is a lot of flexibility here. I mean, if you're noticing, like I mentioned, the case of gradual weaning. There's another solution. This has not happened, actually, but that they're trying to implement in Israel, which is to have a Shabbos clock on the respirator, where they literally put the patient on a respirator with a timer, and then they evaluate every day, let's say every 2 days, whatever it is, and if they say, you know what, this patient still has a chance of survival, extend the clock. If they say, you know what, the patient's dying anyway, so just let it run out, and then it'll turn off the respirator. I mean, they're trying to come up with ways. I'll give you an example.
What's happening is that we're twisting ourselves into a pretzel to try to avoid doing what, in fact, we're doing to this patient, which is killing them. But instead of just killing them in a dignified and in a dignified manner, allowing them to move on from this world, we're twisting ourselves into a pretzel so that it won't feel like.
I hear you. I do hear you, and you make a good point. Though I still think it has an impact on, first of all, on the clinicians, on the family. There's a certain sense of following, you know, Jewish values, of having a sort of sense of guide for what you're doing, and a sense that it does feel different. I mean, I hear what you're saying. You make a strong point. I just don't know if it's just aesthetic or there is something more to it. If it actually is impacting people's moral sensitivities in a way that's deeper than aesthetics.
Forgive me. I'm less concerned with the feelings of the clinic than I am with the pain and suffering of the patient.
I hear. Yes, Zoom, there's a Zoom question. I think, right. Was there a Zoom question?
I think
there are
questions in the chat.
Oh.
Zoom people, you cannot use the chat to ask questions. It's not visible. So if you want to ask the questions that have been in the chat, please unmute and ask them.
Yeah, if anyone on Zoom wants to ask a question, please unmute or just put up your hand and then we'll see you. In the meantime, we'll take one more question. I want to conclude with one thing too, but I want to hear the Zoom questions. Yeah.
Who's Dr. Stein?
Oh, Dr. Avram Steinberg, sorry, is a very prominent pediatric neurologist who's also Talmud Chacham, and he wrote the Encyclopedia of Medical Halacha, and he's been is up there right behind there.
It's on the second.
Yeah, and he's been very influential in Israeli medical law, not just halacha issues. Yeah.
Six volumes of these, 8 volumes of these.
Now the other one is by Rabbi Avraham, who's also.
Oh.
Yeah, that was Dr. Abraham.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
To go back to the Beis Lachem Yehuda
for
a minute, it's didn't seem to me like his problem was the valve had stopped working, but that it shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Right.
Maybe it wasn't understood.
Yeah, so he argued it shouldn't have been in the first place, but the assumption, the way it's read, is that it was put there to keep a dying patient alive. So that was why the salt was placed on the tongue, was because the patient was dying, so it was put there to keep them alive. And now the patient's dying anyways, we realize that it was a mistake, like retroactively, lemafreya. Like, it was put there correctly, but now we see that it was a mistake to put it there. You know what I mean? Because it's the nimsa part. Now we realize it was put there for the wrong reason. At the time they put it there, they hoped it would save his life, for her life. But now they realize it didn't work, so it was wrong to do it. Right. Even though, you're right, it's not totally in the words there, but that's the way it's understood. Sure, yes. Tamar.
Oh, hi. I just want to ask about ECMO. Is that interchangeable with your example of that temporary heart?
Yes. ECMO is very complicated, though, because it also doesn't...
What's
ECMO? ECMO is intervention that is basically both does cardiac and respiratory function. It filters the blood. It circulates the blood and filter and oxygenates the blood. It's a very intensive intervention and it's much more challenging to take someone off of ECMO because they'll die quicker as a result, and their life, it's like you mentioned, it's more like the artificial heart. So it's harder to argue that it's like a respirator where it's a little bit removed. And ECMO removal is a challenge, but there are some ways that you can allow things to conclude. Like with the artificial heart, there's even ways. For example, you can allow the battery to run out. I know it sounds crazy. Obviously, you do this with the person being in an induced coma. But some posthumous said, you know, allow the battery to run out instead of turning it off. And that could be the distinction that we'd make between withholding and withdrawing. There's similar solutions with ECMO.
Building off of Tig's question,
Josh,
when we're pasquining or when we're in a pastoral situation, are we solely focusing on the patient and their well-being and doing the correct thing morally for them? Or are we also considering the morality of the doctors and the medical staff and the family?
I mean, it depends who's asking. Obviously, the doctor and the medical staff has their concerns about their moral commitments, and the patient and the family have their concerns. So, obviously, we're trying to meet everyone's concerns, but...
And how do you balance the two when they're directly...
Well, it could be a big challenge, because sometimes the most common conflict we have is when a family wants to keep a patient alive, and the staff feels that it's challenging them morally, because they feel that they're only... inducing harm on a patient whose body is dying, but they're being told to keep them alive. So they call it moral injury. They feel like, you know, they don't like to being asked to do something that's going against their own values, but the family wants us. So oftentimes we even have to sometimes switch staff. Some staff say, I'm not willing to do this, and other staff have to be involved. Of course, you have sometimes like observant residents saying, like, I'm not willing to be the one to extubate. So you have sometimes have it the other way.
So in a certain sense, then we place the morals of the family above even, because the doctors, in a certain sense, they think they have the morals of the patient in mind. So we're placing the morals of the family above that of the patient.
Well, the family is supposed to represent what the patient wants. So we're supposed to be trying to represent the morals of the patient and trying to accommodate as well as possible within reason. Right. It might not always be the case, but that's the goal. Yeah.
Jason, it's about 12:30.
Yeah. Much as I accept the distinction between withholding and withdrawing, one of the challenges is that sometimes when people are dedicated to this approach of only withholding but not withdrawing, it can actually have a downside, which is that sometimes when people have to make a decision, should I prolong the patient's life? And they're concerned, well, I'm not going to be able to withdraw, so I shouldn't even try to prolong. So sometimes it can have a negative ramification of assuming, since if I can't withdraw, then I might as well not initiate, and that could be a big problem. So thankfully, there are ways that we have to still, work with the system that find ways that are either not considered withdrawing or certain ways.